Jonathan Miller is the Asia correspondent for Channel 4 News in the UK. Jonathan grew up in Southeast Asia, and he knows the region well. In 2016, one of the big stories for him was the presidential election campaign in the Philippines, mainly because of one of the candidates, an unbelievably colourful mayor from the southern island of Mindanao by the name of Rodrigo Duterte. Duterte was running on his record as the mayor of Davao City. He said that he'd been able to destroy the drug trade there through some extremely harsh measures. Duterte had encouraged gangs of masked vigilantes to go out at night and murder people that they believed to be drug users in the streets and in their homes. And sometimes the children of these suspected drug users would also be killed in the crossfire. On the presidential campaign trail, Rodrigo Duterte boasted that he had shot and killed drug users himself, but he was careful not to be too specific with the details. Duterte's plain speaking campaign generated plenty of headlines around the world. He used the insult "son of a whore" in reference to Barack Obama and to Pope Francis. Amazingly, in that most Catholic of countries, this didn't seem to dent Duterte's popularity at all. He flung the same phrase at Jonathan Miller at a press conference for asking a question he didn't like. Duterte won the election in a landslide, and now these vigilante death squads are operating all over the Philippines. And it's estimated that within his first 18 months in office, 12,000 people were murdered on the streets, all with Duterte's encouragement. Jonathan Miller's book is called Duterte Harry. Hello, Jonathan. Welcome.
Thank you, Richard.
Right at the start of your book, there's the story of a Filipino man named Domingo Manyoshka. Can you just tell that story, please, of what happened to him?
Domingo was a pedicab driver, a bicycle taxi driver. And, you know, these guys earn very, very little. And he had three kids, another on the way, and he lived in a really grim slum called Santo Niño.
This is in Manila, is it?
It's in Manila. Now, Manila's a huge, sprawling conurbation. It's Metro Manila, as they call it, is an amalgam, I think, of 16 cities, and they call one municipality. And Santo Niño is just a district of one of these cities called Pasay City. But it's fairly central. It's sort of like not far from Manila Bay. You fly over it as you come in to the international airport. And Domingo Manyoshka was making his living as a bicycle taxi driver, and you know he'd earn, you know, a few cents from one of these trips, and in order to pay off the rental of the pedicab itself, he'd have to do five or six trips before he could actually clear any profit. And his wife wasn't working, his own brother was also working as a bicycle taxi driver, and they all lived sort of on top of each other in this pile of humanity that is Santo Niño slum. And Domingo, like many of the bicycle taxi drivers, took the odd hit of what you in Australia called ice, and in the Philippines is known as shabu, methamphetamine, crystal meth. And
why was he taking that?
Well, it's not a sort of recreational drug. It's not like the glitterati would snort cocaine. It's a drug which is, you know, it might be described as poor man's cocaine, but it basically is rocket fuel if you have a manual job. And a quick hit of crystal meth will mean that you don't have to go to sleep for a couple of days. It means that your appetite doesn't come and sort of niggle you all the time, and you can just go.
So he could work harder, awake longer, and suppress his appetite and earn more as a result by taking this stuff. So what became of him?
Well, Domingo was apparently impressed by this tough-talking mayor from the south of the Philippines who turned up on the electoral ticket in May 2016, and he voted for him.
He voted for Duterte.
He voted for Duterte.
Right.
But within a few months, it became clear that Duterte was serious about his threats to clear out drug addiction, addicts, dealers, clean up. And more of them were ending up dead on the streets. And so a lot of them turned themselves in. And there are amazing photographs of the overpopulated jails where hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these guys would just surrender in the hope that they wouldn't be then shot dead on the street.
And did Domingo do this himself?
Domingo surrendered.
Right.
And he thought by surrendering that he would open himself up to the possibility of getting a bit of rehab, that he was being honest, you know, he was doing the right thing. But what it actually meant was that he had essentially signed his own death warrant. And one day, early in the morning, before he went to work, he was sitting mending a DVD player in second floor, little hovel that he shared with his wife and his kids. And there was a knock on the door, and he shouted, "Yeah, who is it?" No answer. Same again. Nothing happened. And within about 2 minutes, Domingo was dead. But in his case, what happened was that whoever killed him, and the killer was never caught, whoever killed him shoved the barrel of a pistol through the gap between two boards in the side of the room in which the family was living. And the first shot didn't kill Domingo. It killed his six-year-old son, Francis. The second shot killed Domingo. So his wife, who I later went and met, found herself with a dead five-year-old and a dead husband and no income.
The fact that they were pointing the gun barrel through the boards of the wall, that suggests that they were pretty, there was never much care taken to be terribly discriminating in terms of who they shot then, it would seem.
There are a lot of people who get shot accidentally, caught in the crossfire. Mm. In fact, Duterte himself refers to the deaths of children, of which, you know, scores have been killed, as collateral. This is the term which we associate with war.
Yeah, the US Army used to use it in Vietnam. They'd say that if a village was destroyed, that was collateral damage.
Yeah.
Unfortunate, sort of regrettable, but, you know, a necessary death in this war. What was the public reaction to the killing of Domingo and his son?
I learned about the killing of Domingo and his son from the newspapers, and it's not like these killings aren't reported. They are. But it sort of... It started well in that the journalists were reporting what was happening a lot, and then because it became normalised, you got less and less of it. You know, you'd get the odd paragraph here, the odd paragraph there, particularly when, you know, in the case of children being killed, you know, this would still make the headlines. But it became normalised, as I say. It became something which... ordinary Filipinos, particularly if, you know, you're a middle-class, wealthy, educated Filipino, it happened elsewhere. It happened in places that you never actually went to yourself. It happened in the slums.
Typically, how do these vigilante death squads operate when they're going out to shoot and kill?
There is a modus operandi, which was very clearly laid out in a dossier, which I obtained very early on. In my time over in the Philippines, which was later verified as being written by police intelligence people. It set out what I later discovered also to be exactly what was the experience of people on these lists who were being hunted down and killed. There was a term which apparently it derives from what happened in Colombia during the drugs wars there in the 80s. It's called riding in tandem. And what would happen is you'd get two hooded riders, balaclavas, ski masks, helmets, who'd come along on a motorbike, often usually dressed in black, a pistol would be tucked into the belt of the pillion. And they'd come up and they'd just literally knock someone off on the street. I mean, it's instant. It's really fast. And, you know, this happens everywhere. It happens in the slums of the big cities across the Philippines. And it has meant that nobody feels safe. And you can be going through Manila and you'll see a couple of guys on a motorbike pull up next to you as you're sitting in your taxi. And you look up and there they are, two of them.
Oh, here it is. Right.
I mean, it puts the fear of God into people.
How does Duterte encourage this? Is he giving orders to these people directly, or is he making encouraging noises? How does he promulgate these vigilante killings?
Well, in the early days, in his electoral campaign, he kept on saying, "I will kill you, I will kill you, I will kill you. I will fill the funeral parlours. I will dump so many bodies of criminals and addicts in Manila Bay that the fish will grow fat."
He's literally saying, "I will kill you, I will kill you."
Absolutely.
Right.
And not only that, he's encouraging other people to go and kill. So on the day that he was elected, for example, he went down to a huge slum in Metro Manila called Tondo. And in front of men and women and children, he encouraged parents to kill their kids if they were addicts. And he says, "Well, if you can't do that, that's a bit hard, so get somebody else to kill them for you."
He was encouraging parents to kill their kids if they were drug addicts.
That's correct.
But then he said, "If you find you can't do that, just get someone else to kill them then, if that's too hard for you."
So it was overt, Richard. It was absolutely overt orders. But he also worked on a subliminal level. So he would sort of send these dog whistle signals to his cohorts of supporters of the sort of thing that he wanted to happen, and his orders would be interpreted. So it came to happen that the police would be involved in this sort of thing. So some of the killings were by these vigilante killers, who are probably mostly off-duty policemen, and some of the killings were done by the police themselves in what they called mostly buy-bust operations. Like, they'd go in to try to get a dealer, and they'd claim that the dealer or the addict shot back at them, but actually, usually they didn't, and it was, these things were usually fatal, but not for the police.
The people that are being killed, are they drug dealers? Are they drug users? Or are people using it to settle scores with people they don't like?
I think it's very hard with the statistics, because the statistics lie, and it's very, very unclear.
Because that's typically a problem when a leader unleashes bands of vigilantes that under the cover of a war against drugs, they just settle scores against a neighbour who has got a fence in their property.
I think the vast majority of those killed are probably drug addicts or drug dealers. But the big drugs lords are mostly getting away with it. They've rarely been touched. A lot of other people... And I only say this because I've had personal experience of anecdotes told to me by those involved. They claim that they're on these lists or these hit lists as high-value targets in the drugs war because of neighbours wanting to settle personal scores. It's nothing to do with drugs, they claim.
One night you went out to the scene, a crime scene, of a death squad execution, which took place in front of a Dunkin' Donuts. What did you see at the scene? What was going on at the scene and around it?
Well, I mean, this wasn't the first time I'd been out. I mean, there was a whole sort of like new journalistic industry that sprang up when the drugs war started, of what they call the night crawlers, the journalists who would go out on the night shift to just document what was happening. Now, some of these were sort of jobbing reporters who were doing their beat in Metro Manila, and they were young reporters who were exposed to absolutely horrendous carnage on the streets of Manila. And it wasn't just Manila, by the way; there were other cities too. But that's where I went out. When we would go out with my crew filming, it never took long before one of these killings happened, and there would be sort of, the journalists would pick it up from police radio or tips from friends, or sometimes people in the area would call in and you'd get a tip off and off you'd go to the scene of the killing. And this particular night, I had I decided with my editors in London to follow the story of one of these photographers. Now, this guy became a good friend of mine. He's called Luis Liwanag. And he's a very experienced photographer. He wasn't a young guy. He's been around the block a bit. He's in his 50s. He'd started his career during Marcos's time. He'd seen military dictatorship before. He knew about riots. He knew about killing. And when the drugs war started, he decided that he wanted to document what was happening because he felt it was so important. And his colleagues, the younger colleagues, would call him Sir Luis because of his experience. And I was with Sir Luis, and we got a tip off. We were sitting in the press room at police headquarters, we got a tip off that a killing had happened. We raced off because you can quite often get there before the police arrive, and that's what we did on this occasion. And there, on the street, again, it was a bicycle taxi driver, a pedicab driver, poorest of the poor, lying on his back in the road in a pool of blood outside a Mercury drugstore and a Dunkin' Donuts.
Shot dead.
Dead. Two shots, one through the chest, one through the head. And there was a gaggle of children looking on, taking pictures on their iPhones and smartphones. The traffic was going up and down the street just completely normally, slowed down a little bit to get round the dead body on the street.
So no big deal, in other words.
No big deal. No big deal. And then the police arrived and very unhurriedly started to put up these sort of, you know, bits of yellow and black police tape. And they drew a couple of chalk circles on the road where they found a bullet casing. It was unhurried, absolutely normal, happened night after night after night. And I interviewed Luis on the scene for this film I made for Channel 4 News. And he said, you know, it's getting worse. It used to be in the black alley, in the back alleys. Now it's happening on main streets like this. And this was on a big road in Manila called Mandaluyong. And, you know, it was a busy, busy street. There were jeepney taxis going past.
It's that brazen, in other words, yeah.
Brazen. And he said to me, Jonathan, they are being killed like insects.
Now, Duterte, as I said, has claimed to have shot and killed people himself. When he talks about this, what kind of language does he use when he's describing how he has murdered people?
Rough. He talks rough, and they love him.
Well, he's boasting. That. He boasts about it.
Oh yeah, he loves boasting about it. He claims to have chucked corrupt officials out of helicopters, narco style. He claims to have shot people who were drug dealers in the city which he ran as mayor for 22 years. He claims to have killed when he was 16 years old in a fight on a beach, and he makes these claims, but nobody really knows if it's true. But he claims it is.
Why would he self-incriminate? I mean, that's an extraordinary thing for a president to say, or anyone to say publicly in front of the media. Oh yeah, I shot and killed someone.
I know, it's like nuts. That. But he, you know, because he doesn't give the details, nobody can really, really pin down whether or not he did it.
What's your sense? Is this empty boasting? Do you think it's true? I mean, what do you make of that, Jonathan?
Well, look, nobody really knows, but. The thing is that there's a contrived mythology which Duterte has built up about himself, which I find absolutely fascinating. The deeper I dug into his past, it became very clear to me what was going on. He speaks the language of the poor. That's why they love him. They think he's one of theirs. He's what's known in his local Bisayan culture from the south of Mindanao as a bugoy. A bugoy is a hoodlum. His own father called him a hoodlum, and with good reason, because what happened was, although he speaks this salty language, he's a very privileged kid, or he was when he was young, because his dad was the governor of Davao, which was, in those days, a province. It wasn't just a city.
So he's no rough as guts, you know, poor kid from the slums, up from the slums. He's a little prince, in other words.
He's a little prince. But he makes out as though he's a slum kid. He said, oh, excuse me, sorry for my bad language, but, you know, it's the way I was brought up. Nonsense. This guy was brought up with really special treatment. And the reason he can assume this persona, this character acting that he does, is because he was given a bodyguard. And he used to go with his bodyguard and hang out with other bodyguards and slope off school. He'd be playing hooky and he'd go off with the bodyguards and he'd listen to the way they talked and they leered at women and the way they smoked and he'd sleep around. And, you know, by his own confession, actually, over the years, he's let slip little things about how he grew up, and his sisters told me about this too. The bodyguards were absolutely essential in his acquisition of this character, which he sort of came to believe himself. So he became Duterte Harry.
Tell me about the incident that Duterte claims has made him hostile towards the Catholic Church and would lead him to say such a thing about the Pope in a very, very Catholic country.
Duterte, I mean, yes, I mean, the Philippines is almost as Catholic as the Vatican. I mean, you know, it's 80% Catholic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I'm right in saying it's you know, I saw that Ireland had voted the other day to get rid of the abortion laws. And, But they still remain in place in the Philippines. And you can't get divorced in the Philippines as well. You have to get marriages annulled. And, you know, it's not the sort of place where you call the Pope the son of a whore. But Duterte was, he's driven by this rage against the Catholic Church. He said so many things over the years where he just, you know, he talks about the hypocrisy of the church. He lambasts bishops, priests who he feels exhibit this hypocrisy. And it comes down in part to the fact that he claims to have been abused at a school as a kid. And the Catholic priest he claims did it was indeed an abuser of the First Order. He was an American called Father Falvey, who is long dead. He died in 1975. But in the 60s and 70s, he was in the Philippines, and then he went back to America, and he was accused of abusing children in Hollywood, on Hollywood Boulevard, I think it was.
So Duterte's claim is quite plausible then, given this man is a record.
And Duterte said it was this experience that caused him to, in his words, lose his innocence.
He, as you mentioned, they don't have divorce laws, but you have to fight to get your marriage annulled in the Philippines. When he was here and his former wife were trying to get their marriage annulled in the courts, you write that there was a clinical psychologist that was commissioned to assess Duterte's character. This is back in 1989. Tell me what came out of that assessment of his character, which was, it must be said, made at a distance and without having interviewed Duterte about the whole throughout this process.
I mean, yeah. Look, there is a caveat to this, which is that this was an assessment which his wife consulted a psychiatrist to draw up in order to get the annulment,
yeah.
And Duterte agreed to it. It wasn't a direct assessment of him, but it fits completely with what we understand to be the character traits and behavioural traits of Duterte, and it's astonishingly prescient, to be honest. And bits of it came out in the press just before the election, and he was described by this very distinguished psychologist as having a narcissistic personality disorder with aggressive features, and she talked about his gross indifference, his insensitivity, his grandiose sense of self and entitlement, his manipulation, and you know, she talked about his inability to control his urges and emotions. Now,
is he a liar? Is he a he's a liar.
He's right. A liar.
He lies in public and contradicts himself all the time.
I mean, on every level. So, you know, so he'll make these ludicrous claims and think people go, "Oh my God, seriously?" And then he'll say, "Ah, I was only joking." And you never know when he is joking or when he wasn't, because some of the things that he claims are indeed true. And he once said only two or three of the things out of five that I say are actually true. But one thing I can tell you that is absolutely relevant to the carnage of his drugs war is that it is based on a lie. The figures that he quotes are lies. He has made them up. He has grossly exaggerated them. And he's conned his country of 100 million people into believing his lies.
You're talking about here his claims that as mayor of Davao City, he'd made it a drug-free haven, brought down the crime rates, and made it as safe as Singapore. That's what's the reality of that, as you understand?
Well, yeah, that's another lie. I mean, I was actually talking about the numbers of the drugs war and the numbers of addicts, because there are probably per capita more drug addicts in Australia than in the Philippines, and there are probably about 1.8 million people who, and that's not just crystal meth, I mean, that's drugs across the board, dabbling, some of them. He, within months, was telling the Philippines that there were 5 million drug addicts. As to Davao City, the city which he ran as mayor for 22 years and claimed he'd cleaned up, he said, "Oh, it used to be the murder capital of the Philippines." Well, guess what? It still is. And if he cleaned up on drugs in Davao City, why is it that within a few weeks or days, I think, of his being elected, 17,000 crystal meth addicts surrendered so that they wouldn't be shot down in cold blood?
One of the tricks that authoritarian leaders have sometimes is they don't order someone to be killed. They just say, well, someone do something about this person that's really bothering me at the moment, without specifying what exactly they want done about it. It's a mafia boss tactic as well. Is Duterte fond of this kind of thing? Is he careful to sort of not say, go out and order this specific person, or does he just sort of complain a bit about the person and will someone take care of this?
That's exactly how he does it. One of his great political rivals in Davao, who'd lost out to him over many years, but was himself a very distinguished politician, was the Speaker of Congress. And his name is Prospero Nograles, described him as being a sort of like a mafiosi boss. He said, well, you know, I've got a stone in my shoe.
You can't father have a stone in my
go
shoe.
Go kill them.
Right. That's it. Has he named any people that with the suggestion that they ought to be killed? Has he read out names like drug users?
He has got an encyclopedic list of those he accuses of being drugs lords, drug addicts, drugs dealers, and he waves it around, brandishes it. Nobody knows how many people are on this list, but he terrifies people by thinking that their names might be on it, because if your name is on that list and your name is read out, you might as well have a target painted on your back.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and on your mobile.
In 1989, while Duterte was the mayor of Davao City in the south of the Philippines, there was a hostage crisis in their local prison colony there. A gang of convicts had taken a group of missionaries hostage. Duterte was the man on point as the local mayor. Tell me a bit, Jonathan, how he handled that hostage crisis, please.
I think it was probably the biggest thing that he'd had to deal with, because he hadn't been mayor for very long, probably a year or so. And what had happened was that this prison gang, who called themselves the Wild Boys, had taken over. They'd snatched an M16 semi-automatic and taken control of this penal colony in Davao. And among the hostages were this group of missionaries, one of whom was a foreigner called Jacqueline Hamill. She was an Australian, 36-year-old Australian missionary, and they belonged to an evangelical group called the Joyful Assembly of God. And Duterte and his old classmate, who's now one of his cabinet ministers, Jess Dureza, who was put in charge of trying to negotiate, had failed in the negotiations with the hostage takers, and so the decision was taken to shoot to kill. That was Duterte's decision. In the accounts that you read in the Sydney Morning Herald at the time and in other local newspaper reports in the Philippines, Duterte's name does not figure, which is bizarre, because he later, in the election campaign of 2016, claimed that he was front and centre of the whole of what happened. But in this debacle, Jacqueline Hamill was fatally shot. Five of the hostages were shot. All of the hostage takers were shot dead.
Shot by the prisoners or by the soldiers of police he brought in to deal with the crisis?
It is thought that it was a sniper bullet. Therefore, one of the police killed Jacqueline Hamill. There's a photograph which is very striking. It's an old black and white photograph showing Jacqueline Hamill at the front of a group of hostages with all the hostage takers behind, with the brandishing their weapons, marching them out, trying to get their way out of the penal colony, and I think it was, you know, probably within minutes of Hamill's death, and you know it was a terrible and tragic event, and it was badly handled, and you know an investigation called into question this shoot to kill order that Duterte himself ordered.
Now, it turned out that Jacqueline Hamill had been raped many times by these prisoners while she was their hostage. How did Duterte talk about her on the campaign trail when he was running for the presidency in 2016?
Well, you know, it was bizarre that, you know, all this time had elapsed between that incident and the presidential campaign of 2016 without really that tragic story having, you know, been raised at all. And then Duterte was the one who raised it in a campaign address in a huge stadium in Quezon City in Manila. Duterte told what happened, but it was his version of it, in which he said, I gave the order, kill them all, shoot them all. And he made this sort of like, you know, machine gun noise. And the crowd laughed and loved it. And he said the only thing that was so terrible about this, he said, was that there was this beautiful, beautiful woman. And I looked at her face and he said, son of a bitch, she was so beautiful. She was like an actress. And you know, he told this story on the stage, holding one of these sort of like cordless microphones, and the crowd was hanging on every word, and they would laugh as he paused for a dramatic effect. And then he said, son of a bitch, what a waste. What came to my mind, this is actually what he said, what a waste. What came to my mind was they raped her. They lined up for her. And I was angry because she was raped. That was one thing, but she was so beautiful. The mayor should have been first. What a waste.
So he likes rape jokes, huh?
It wasn't his last. It's, you know, he's got no filters. He doesn't seem to get that you don't make jokes about that.
This would have made, I expect, our government very angry.
It did.
And how did he respond to the protestations from our government?
Well, the Australian ambassador used Twitter. And I discovered that it was a very, very, very carefully worded tweet that was put out.
She tweeted that violence against women and girls is unacceptable, Ambassador did.
Yeah, it's pretty neutral.
And did that get up Duterte's nose?
Yeah, because there's, you see, Duterte is a lawyer, and we discussed about how he's been very careful not to self-incriminate with so much detail that it's prosecutable. Well, he also knows election laws, and in election laws in the Philippines, for any foreign party to take sides or be perceived to be taking sides is against the law and prosecutable. So
he played it like our government was trying to interfere
exactly
in the presidential election process.
Exactly. And he did the same with the Americans. And his riposte to the Americans was he referred to the American ambassador who complained about exactly the same thing, calling him a gay son of a bitch.
Mindanao, where he comes from, the southernmost large island in the Philippines archipelago down there, that has for decades now been going through a rebellion from an Islamist insurgency down there. What's his relations like with the insurgent leaders of the Moro rebellion in Mindanao?
Well, the Moro, as you say, are the Muslims of Mindanao. And interestingly, you know, the name Moro was given to them as the Southern Muslims. And this is what the
well, like
the Spanish,
Moors, you mean? Like the Spanish
exactly,
Moors, that, right.
But the Moors are called the Moors in Spain because the Spanish colonial authorities in the Philippines called the Moro the Moors. And so it became a sort of like a generic term for the Muslims of the South. Anyway, the Moro of the Philippines are from Mindanao. There are many different ethnic groups, but Duterte himself is from a mixed family. His mother was a Maranao, one of the Muslim tribes, and his father's side was Catholic. And you get a lot of that sort of intermarriage, but
now the Moros make claims of institutional oppression of them, and there's some truth to that, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely terrible. Yeah. For centuries, they have fought the efforts of the Spanish colonial authorities, the priests who came and with the conquistadors, essentially, sort of like trying to occupy their lands and send down Catholics from the north to settle them.
So
the Americans did the same.
So does Duterte have some sympathy for their point
absolutely.
Of view?
Absolutely. And he's got a big chip on his shoulder about it. I mean, there were terrible massacres done over many centuries, not least by the Americans who followed the Spanish as the colonial power for 50 years.
So might he be able to actually bring peace to Mindanao, given that he's spoken out sympathetically about the Moro rebellion in the south?
Well, that was the great hope, Richard, because, you know, here was a guy who was the first ever president from Mindanao. He had links with the Moro. He'd allowed them, rebel leaders, to enter his city while he was mayor there. He also had very close links to the communists, and some people thought he was possibly of communist inclination himself. Now, the communists, you might think, are a sort of thing of the past and died with the Soviet Union. Not so. In the Philippines, there is an ongoing war by the New People's Army, the NPA, which are communist insurgents. They're still in the jungle, killing, shooting, and there's a lot of sort of making a killing as well. So there's rackets and corruption, but there is a real insurgency, both by the Moro, who some of them are on the jihadist end of the spectrum, and communists who are still fighting for justice and equality.
President Duterte didn't care much for Barack Obama. He called him a son of a whore, like he did other people, yourself included. I've got to get you to tell that story too, by the way. How does he get along with President Trump, who got elected a mere, 6 months or so after his own election?
Well, his first run-in with Trump was interesting because Trump included the Philippines in a country in a list of countries which he insulted, as I can't remember, in the same vein as he insulted Mexicans and
us too. Yeah. You mean like countries that are pretty much hanging off like parasites who are hanging off the mere U.S. defense budget.
And Duterte loves nothing more than a bit of a scrap with a foreign leader, particularly if he's American. So he'd already sort of said what he said about Obama, and he challenged Trump to a boxing match. Said, "Come to Manila, I'll smash you." So it didn't start well. But they discovered, or Duterte discovered, that actually in Trump he had a friend. Duterte not only rang him and supported his war on drugs, saying, "Rodrigo, you're doing it right. We've got a drugs problem too, but you're really doing it right."
President Trump told him he was going about the war on drugs in the right way.
He did
right. Nonetheless, he seems to be moving the Philippines closer away from the United States, and which it has a military alliance, and towards China and Russia. This is really fascinating for me because China pretty much has taken over the Scarborough Shoals, that shoal of islands that lies between China and the Philippines. It's pretty much kicked the Philippines out of there and taken it over for themselves. And yet he wants to move closer to China. Is that some kind of recognition of, I don't know, realpolitik? Like China, United States is retreating from East Asia. We now just have to be nice to China and just put up with this stuff? Or is there an affinity there? What's your assessment of all that?
I just don't know where to start. Because, I mean, it's so confused. It's really hard to sort of pick it apart. And as a foreign correspondent, it's my job to do this. And I look at the Philippines, I just don't know how to explain it simply.
Well, in Australian terms, it'd be like, it's like China took Lord Howe Island off the East Coast, and then we said, well, we like China a lot more now, we're going to move closer to
them. And they're going to give us some money and invest a bit of stuff, and they're going to help us out with this, and a bit of infrastructure money too. Yeah, I mean, that is happening. But, you know, the Philippines has had a 70-year alliance with the United States. It has protected the Philippines. It's had bases in the Philippines. They've got a very solid defense pact, as does Australia for that matter. But with the United States, you know, it was a very, very close bond that they had and have, actually, because there are few countries that love the United States as much as the Philippines.
Now that's based because on the role the United States had in kicking out the Imperial Japanese in the Second World War, isn't it? There's those bonds of affection that do exist are largely because of that, the Second World War?
Not necessarily because of that. I mean, there was also 50 years of American colonialism in the Philippines. Mm. And actually, by and large, the Americans came out on top of that, apart from the odd massacre in Mindanao. But, you know, there's a closeness between the two. But with Duterte, he has got a chip on his shoulder of the first order with the Americans. He was denied a visa, seemingly because there was growing concern, I think in around sort of the late 80s, early 90s, over his human rights issues.
And there was all that boasting about having shot and killed people,
yeah,
too. There was a bit of that.
It had begun to raise eyebrows.
That'll get questions asked at the immigration gate, I'm sure, won't it?
Well, you know, I've got to say, you know, do you remember when the WikiLeaks stuff came out? Well, buried amongst these diplomatic cables was stuff about the Philippines that was written way back in like the mid-90s and before, in which American diplomats were expressing extreme disquiet to the State Department about this mayor of this city called Davao, saying that he was running death squads and pointing up exactly what was happening. And there was one three-week period in the beginning of January 1995 when, like, more than 20 people were killed in as many days. And it had come to the notice of the Americans. So it seems that was linked to their not allowing him to go into the United States. And there was also, while he was mayor, an American who came to Davao, and there was an explosion in the city. And the guy was accused by Duterte of getting up to some nefarious tricks and goodness knows what he was up to. But when he was taken to hospital, it seems that the FBI or the CIA came in and secreted him, spirited him out of the city. And this infuriated Duterte. So he's always had this big thing about the Americans and really, really disliking them. And it's a personal thing. It's visceral. And he makes the point at every possible occasion, we are not your doormat. And he will say this openly to the American ambassador and to visiting secretaries of state. And that has been part of the realignment with China and Russia, to whom he looks as a sort of like, he wants to be part of a new Eastern sphere where he feels a sense of belonging to this part of the world, and he wants to get rid of the old alliances. But as you say, it's raised a lot of eyebrows in the Philippines, not least in the diplomatic community, where there are genuine concerns about getting into bed with a country like China, which has got such clear and aggressive territorial ambitions in the South China Sea.
How about you? He's got a bit of a, like most authoritarian leaders, he's got a bit of a no back chat policy when it comes to being asked impertinent questions. Mm. What was the question that got him lashing out at you at a press conference personally?
I decided to go down to Davao City on a couple of occasions to question him, because it's quite hard to get hold of him when he's in Manila, but he holds these sort of long, rambling press conferences, which start at absurd times of day, like 1 a.m. And in Davao, it's a lot easier to get into these things.
And how long do these press conferences last?
Hours.
So he's like Castro. Castro used to do that, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, call in journalists and talk for 3 hours.
Well, I mean, among Filipino journalists, there's this sort of deference which comes from, I guess, it's a sort of filial piety thing. It's Asian. It's sort of like, respect your elders. Yeah. And they don't like to interrupt him. And he wangs on and on and on and on. And then once he's run out of things that he can think of to say, he'll throw the floor open and he'll be asked sort of sometimes rather sycophantic questions, which will spark him off again, and he'll go on for another couple of hours.
So when he took your question, what did you ask?
Right, he'd just come back from meeting his hero, Putin, at a summit, and he arrived in Davao, got off the plane, went up to the podium, ranted and raved about Marcos and how brilliant Marcos was, the former dictator. He just at that stage given the nod to his reburial in the Cemetery of Heroes in Manila. So he talked about Marcos for a bit, and then it didn't take very long for him to get onto his war on drugs. And he said, we are a narco state, just like those Latin American narco states. So I got up and asked a question. I said, well, look, the trouble with these narco states that you're talking about is that, you know, they're also associated with the sort of Latin American style death squad. And you've been running death squads, and since you came to power, you know, at that stage, it was. I mean, I say only 6,000 people had been shot dead on the streets. And I said, you know, you seem to have a national death squad. And, first of all, he confused me. He didn't realize that I was a Brit, and he thought I was an American. So he had a go at me just because I was American. He says, you're president. He's sort of like, what's the difference between killing black people? And what's happening here is no difference at all. The logic, there's no logic to his rationale here. So I said, Mr. President, Barack Obama doesn't sanction these killings himself. You know, this just happens that the police in the States are killing like this. But he took grave exception to my perceived impertinence and called me a son of a whore. And of course, this caused great amusement in the press room. But it was also broadcast live on TV, and within 24 hours, a clip of it had received, I think, 12, 13 million hits on YouTube, and I was being recognised in the street as the guy who'd asked the question about the death squads. Now, you know, this was okay because, you know, I don't mind as a journalist being a lightning rod like this, but It was very. It's typical of Duterte. He's arrogant and narcissistic, but incredibly thin-skinned. And anybody who asks him questions that he doesn't like, he thrashes out, lashes out, and you become the victim.
Well, yeah. Have you got a target on your back now? Your concern about motorcycles with pillion passengers pulling out beside you.
I'm very fortunate that the desk in front of me, Richard, has got wood, because I'm going to touch it 3 times and say, look, I'm fortunate. I live elsewhere in Southeast Asia. I don't live in the Philippines, but I have had to take great efforts to protect friends, colleagues, sources of mine in the Philippines who I cannot acknowledge in the book. I cannot quote them in the book. You know, great friends of mine who've and this book is not a foreign correspondent's judgment about you know, me swaggering into the Philippines and saying, here's what's going on. This book is drawn on stories, observations, thoughts of Filipino friends of mine from all walks of life.
You mentioned there he's full of praise for the former dictator of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos, the president who was there from the 60s to the mid-80s or thereabouts. Marcos took dictatorial power by declaring martial law. Is he set to do the same thing? Is Duterte going to declare, is there an expectation he's going to declare martial law and seize power over the courts and the Congress in the same way?
Well, you know, it's possible that the way things have gone, he may just not need to. But that has been the fear. According to his old roommate and former foreign secretary when he was at university in Manila studying law, he was in a hostel room with this friend of his when the tanks rolled over the bridges of Manila in September 1972 when Marcos declared martial law. And Duterte himself went into hiding. He was scared. But he has repeatedly threatened to declare martial law in the Philippines. The first time he did so was when I was there, and it was in reference to criticisms made by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who has just been fired. Now, what Duterte did do was in response to an Islamist rebellion in a town called Marawi in Mindanao, he declared what came down in the Philippines as partial martial. So he declared martial law across Mindanao, which is like a third of the country.
So he's done this before. There is some form with this,
yeah,
in other words.
But you know what he's done since then, and he has undermined and destroyed the very pillars of democracy. He owns Congress. He has lambasted the Catholic Church. He has jailed his critics. He's bullied the media.
And he still enjoys very, very strong popular
support.
And
he's really popular. He's more popular now than when he was first elected. So he doesn't really need to create or to declare martial law because he owns the place.
It's, I don't know. It seems, is there a lesson here? Insofar as the Philippines is a poor country surrounded by much richer countries, like, you know, Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand. They're much wealthier countries that are its near neighbours. And there's been spectacular and famous corruption in Philippines amongst its elite, amongst its establishment, for decade after decade after decade. And it's just, it's so entrenched. It's one of the most corrupt nations in that part of the world. Is this what happens when you have a situation where poverty is left to fester for so long, where the country's establishment takes no interest in their welfare? Eventually they're going to reach for a strong man like Duterte, who offers simple solutions for very, very hard problems.
Yeah, I think you nailed it with that one. I mean, you know, the Philippines, 30 years has elapsed since Marcos. It's been 30 years where people have forgotten what it's like to live under a strong man. And this is a country where corruption, as you say, is rife, where various elitist, autocratic oligarchs have ruled with impunity for decades. And here comes a straight-talking guy from the South who says, I'll fix it. The courts are knackered. We'll fix it. We'll do it our way. I'll do it my way. But, you know, I was very struck when I was writing this book by the words of Margaret Atwood, who you know, her book,
the author of The Handmaid's Tale.
Handmaid's Tale, and there's a quote in The Handmaid's Tale, which I thought was so pertinent in discussing Duterte. And she wrote about how we lived as usual by ignoring. Ignoring isn't the same as ignorance. You really have to work at it. And what was happening, she said, you know, in a gradually heating bathtub, you'd be boiled alive before you knew it. And I think that's what's happened in the Philippines. People have ignored the excesses of Duterte.
One of the things I found from reading your book is that he talks about death every chance he gets, death, yeah, and killing. He's, yeah, really, he seems to be someone who's really interested in death. He kind of has a psychopath's interest in it.
Yeah.
How's his own health? He's an old man, actually. He's much older than he looks. How's his health getting on? How is he approaching his own death anytime soon?
Well, he likes to make out that he's on death's door. He'll tell people quite often that he's really ill, or rumors will circulate that he's got some awful, you know, fatal disease, terminal disease. But he always sort of like comes back into the ring. He'll disappear for days. But those who know him best say he wants to see what happens when he does duck out and what vultures start to circle, because he likes to keep an eye on who might be a threat to him.
Like Comrade Stalin. What a grim story, and it's opened my eyes to what's been going on in our part of the world. Thank you so much, Jonathan. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you, Richard.
Jonathan Miller is Asia correspondent for Channel 4 News in the UK, and his book is called Duterte Harry, which, as you may have guessed, is a kind of pun on Dirty Harry, a title that Duterte likes for himself. Duterte Harry, Fire and Fury in the Philippines. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.